It's Monday, April 5th. This is LA Podcast episode 168. We are here. Well, I'm here, Scott Frazier. Alyssa Walker is here. Heath Davenport is absent, but in his place we have the wonderful Matt Tinoco, independent journalist of, well, not of anything.
Of, I guess that's of what independent means. Independent journalist is the way to go. Thank you for having me. Of your inbox and Twitter feed, and maybe an occasional like URL or maybe a broadcast signal occasionally.
Ooh, but
doing the Home for Who newsletter, which is a fantastic source for information on the twin crises that dominate so much of the discourse and also of real people's lives here in California, the housing and homelessness crises. Matt, we are so thankful that you are helping us out by guest hosting this episode. How are you?
Not bad, honestly. I mean, it's a Sunday morning. I live in Southern California. The ozone pollution has returned, so my respiratory system is
it's so bad.
It was not there for a little period of time, and then I was reminded, oh, it's so nice to live here, and now it has reverted back to, oh right, polluted hellhole. Like, I'm from here, I love it, but like,
wait,
also
that's what it is.
I used my box fan air filters, and it's also a really nasty. So it's a double. So it's like my seasonal allergies are nasty. But anyway, so the particulate matter is also, you know, it's back.
Yeah, I mean, the burning in your lungs means it's springtime here in Southern California. So this is an episode where we wanted to follow up with the recent events, the night raids on Echo Park Lake. In order to help us do that, not only do we have Matt, but later in this episode, we're going to have a long discussion about the fallout from that with Knock LA journalist Jamie Loftus. Please stay tuned for that. It's a great conversation. Before we get to that, though, we do have some other news to cover for a little bit of housekeeping. First, we have a new episode of The 10 up for our Sepulveda pass holders. That is with Cudahy Vice Mayor Liz Alcantar. And it's a great one, honestly.
She's so great.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
She's wonderful.
Really the best.
We absolutely love her. And check it out if you are a pass holder. Anybody have an LA story for this week besides the air trying to poison you? I guess I can start. I got vaccinated. I'm partially vaxxed. So I think I mentioned going out there with my partner Sarah for her vaccination. Because I am doing in-person outreach with Streetwatch LA, they're everybody was like, you should do this too, because you're putting...
And because you're a journalist. Journalists are allowed to
maybe
now too.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of.
Possibly.
Your non-existent press credentials.
What is the deal with that? Because they said it was kind of like a take-backsies situation.
Yeah. No, I think it was... Matt and I talked about this at length, because we were technically essential workers from the very first health order. So I think you could have made that argument the entire time, but now there is a very concerted effort. And even the FEMA site this week was, recruiting journalists to come and get them vaccinated specifically. So
anyway, I went to Dodger Stadium. I got my only thing about this was I had, a really, not encouraging set of interactions with the frankly wonderful volunteers who are on the site, where I showed up at the entrance to Dodger Stadium. They're like, do you have any allergies? I was like, yeah, I have an allergy to this antibiotic. And the woman who asked me that, she kind of just like paused, and she's like, well, just make sure that you tell them that when you get down there. And so then I did that. And the nurse who was about to give me the shot had like the same reaction. She was like, well, maybe we'll just have you stay here for a while longer to I was like, damn, am I about to die in the parking
later,
lot at Dodger
still
Stadium?
Still sitting in the parking lot
at
Dodger Stadium.
Well, I mean, I got a very, very low grade fever, like pretty much as low as you would consider being a fever. I think I had the pretty normal, moderate side effects that other people were reporting. Everything is fine. And also, I feel a weird optimism that is also maybe a side effect of the injection.
Yes.
Who else? What else happened?
Well, we're just going on the back. Like, I mean, in the are journalists eligible or not? So I was lucky to get the shot not last Friday when you're listening, but April. I got a Johnson & Johnson shot on, I don't remember the date, but it's 2 weeks before mm-hmm. April 9th, which is when I become quote unquote fully vaccinated. But what happened, I feel like it's a very indicative way of how the vaccine rollout works for like everyday people. So it turned out Kaiser made it known that on the DL, basically, that communications and IT essential workers if you show up at a Kaiser site, you can get the shot. And their website reflected this. And a number of reporters called Kaiser's PIOs, and the PIO said, "Yep, that's accurate. Your journalists are eligible, so make up an appointment at one of the sites. It's fine. Go." I got it that next morning on Friday, but while I was sitting in the like waiting area, after you get the shot, they make you wait for like 15 or 20 minutes to make sure there's no adverse allergic reaction. And I'm looking through my Twitter feed, and then I was like, "Oh, Kaiser seems to be rolling this back." It was, we will honor existing appointments, but we're actually going to make it in line with what the state's recommendations were. Which the state's recommendations under the Newsom order early on, like journalists and frontline reporters are media communications, IT essential workers, but the state had not opened up that work category yet.
Right.
Though Kaiser's website basically said we're taking anybody who's an essential worker on this list, and I believe at this point the public facing website has been changed to the language does not exactly reflect that anymore, and so they said that we will honor the existing appointments, but for the time being we're back in line with the state. And the reason I say that is because it is, I feel like, as I learn more and more about who in my own friends group has gotten a shot and when they got the shot, I'm like, I would not have anticipated, and like based off of an employment sort of situation, whether or not somebody works in a, like I interpreted the word congregate to mean like somebody who's working in like a congregate living situation, but apparently other people have different interpretations of that word. And then ultimately when you go and show up at a vaccination site, for the most part, it seems like it's just, you have an appointment, you do,
nobody
great,
asks
here you
anything.
Go.
Yeah.
So.
Don't you think this was just a plan for them to figure out which people they should be arresting at the next protest by getting all the journalists to come forward and they're like documenting?
Kaiser's in the pocket of Michael Moore in the LPD.
I was also thinking it's like,
I just need to take your picture really fast before I give
but
you
But I was
a
also
shot.
Thinking it means the like Kaiser communications workers are also in there too, as like you said, like this was, I have no, there's no positive knowledge. Yeah.
Whoever writes the press release can start to tweak the language of the press release. So. But FEMA did have this clinic, so there were a lot of journalists that did, I think, get vaccinated, which is very, very exciting, no matter what the
point being that the optimism, I feel that too, although I'm, as I keep watch
is
over,
that a side effect? How long does that last?
It,
2 weeks.
It hit me really hard for after 12 hours. I was like fevers and chills, and then like 48 hours after, I felt fine. So
you felt heavy optimism.
Yeah. But I mean, also like just a really deep frustration that like I am privileged in that I, as soon as that information was made available, I was in a position to go and click on the website, and lo and behold, there was an appointment in Long Beach,
mm-hmm.
and I have a car, so I can go drive right to Long Beach. But like I watch the press releases from County Public Health every single day, the like case numbers and the deaths, and the thing that I can't get over is even now, so many months on, we're still logging 30, 40, 50 deaths a day in LA County, and consistently
70.
Yeah, and like consistently a third of those are 80 plus, which is what it's been for this entire time. But I'm like, those are people who likely got infected while like months after they became eligible for a vaccination. And like, it seems to be at this particular moment, we're getting to a point where you can walk to your local pharmacy and say, hey, I would like the COVID vaccine. But like, it just, like, as I was at a grocery store last week, was that last week? It was last week. Like, I'm just looking around. I'm in the grocery store midday at John's, and like, there's so many people, like abuelas in their 70s, like wandering around the grocery store getting their stuff. And I'm like, why isn't there like a county public health booth in the parking lot of like clearly this gathering point in the local community? Like, there's not even a CVS within like immediate walking distance of that particular area. And it's just like, I mean, I know this has just been said over and over, but like the entire vaccination process benefits the like technologically literate and those who are technologically literate adjacent. And
well, I mean, like it really does. Like you're absolutely right. It really does. But at the same time, like I also, it benefits the technologically literate, but also part of the way that it does that is because even if you are technologically literate, I personally did not find the process easy at all. Yeah. Once I had done it for my partner, then the second time when I was doing it myself, it was like, okay, now I know how to navigate this. But for the first time person trying to do this, which is, I think almost everybody is a first time person as when they're trying to secure a vaccination appointment, it was very difficult. It was very difficult to figure out where I should be looking, whether or not there were actually appointments open, because sometimes it would say that there weren't, but there actually were. And all of that is incredibly intimidating, even if you even if you're like a tech native, like, you know, even if you are somebody who grew up using these sorts of applications. And so for people who are most at risk of dying of COVID, yeah, it's likely very, very frustrating. I don't know. I mean, what you're saying is not a way that I've heard it framed, Matt, that you know, the people who are currently dying now, dozens of people every day, are all people who have been eligible and could have received the vaccine long before they were exposed. Yeah. I haven't really heard politicians frame it does seem like every day it's increasingly more a drumbeat of we're, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. We're making our way through this, even nationally, as we see potentially a fourth spike in COVID cases taking off, which could, of course, be replicated here. But I don't really see the messaging of nobody else needs to die of, you know, we could target these vaccines to the people who are going to die if they get this. We, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem like that particular messaging is prominent at this point in time, even though that seems potentially to be the case.
We vaccinated a third of the LA County population, which is unbelievable. I mean, really just, and they said what? They gave out like 8 million shots nationwide in 48 hours or something like that. We're giving out shots at a rate of like astounding, you know, millions and millions of people every day are getting them. So it does seem like at some point that will change. Like there will be like a point where the deaths will just plummet.
But it's incumbent on getting the like 65 plus who are
the 65%.
Like, I mean, I don't know if you have grandkids, maybe great, but a lot of people don't.
Or maybe they've been sick in the hospital for a long time, and you know, it's hard to know. Yeah, but yeah, you're right.
Let's get into. I mean, so we have. While we're on the subject of COVID and the accelerated return to normalcy that people are really eager for, this month ushered in the reopening of local museums, including LACMA and the Natural History Museum at Expo Park, both of which reopened on the first of the month. We're also hearing that because new cases have remained so low, positivity rates as well, that we are potentially looking at a mid-month reopening for live concert venues. Are you guys going to see live concerts?
outside. I don't
These know. Are da- indoor. These Dodger are specifically indoor.
Yeah, indoor. No, I'm saying personally, stay outside. You have Dodgers the opening day this week for a 10,000 person. Did they bump that? It's probably still the same 10,000 capacity. With we were joking, cardboard cutouts in all 40,000 rest of the seats would be amazing. That's not really true, but
it's like, how does that work? Do you have a vaccination site and a Dodger game on at the same time?
Oh, wow. Yes, they can. They're going to keep it. They're going to keep. I mean, that's how many parking lots we have.
That parking lot might be too big.
We're going to also have voting. You can vote in the recall election. Go to a baseball game. Get vaccinated. Wow. All in the same.
It's almost like you should.
It's
a city in miniature. We could also have a like an Elon Musk spaceport in part of it. Like that he's doing in Texas.
No, a gondola, Scott. A gondola.
By the time we get to May, at least for some portion of the population, it does seem like they're, honestly, if you go outside already, it feels like things are more normal-esque than they have been in a really long time.
Bars that don't serve food this week, also inside drinking in bars without food, that starts this week too, right? On Monday.
Wow, it's gonna be hard for me to resist the temptation to go back to the drawing room. This is something I've been curious about. Now I can ask, because we've all had at least partial vaccination, do you feel immediately like it changes your perception of what is safe behavior for you, or have you felt like psychologically it has remained the same?
It will change on April 9th. That's my
Hey, opening day. You can go to opening day with no qualms. I'm still worried because I have kids.
And they're not eligible.
Don't want to mess up the but I heard that people are trying to sell, buy breast milk from vaccinated moms to feed their children, even if they're not babies, because they think the antibodies are being passed on. Side note.
The white market.
So I'm going to try to get some white market vaccinated milk to put in my children's cereal. So I'm still worried about the school thing. And, you know, we're supposed to go back in person maybe on the 12th, I think. I don't know if that date has shifted again, but really trying to still limit interactions and do all those things. Feeling slightly less stressed out about it. We did ride the train this week and the bus, and I let my kids pick where to go, and the first time they had been on metro train in a year.
Oh man.
But we went on off peak hours still because I wanted to make sure we weren't, you know, taking up somebody's seat who needed to get to work.
I feel like people's behavior, you can see it, like I said, you can see it outside, but I also feel like people's behavior is just going to start changing really rapidly. And I say that because I am a born killjoy, and I feel like I could like run through a wall right now. And I have to temper that. Like, you know, your rational mind has to temper that and be like, no, you know, it's really, your situation is not night and day. And even if it were, there's still a lot of people for whom the same safety risks are applicable as they have been for the last year. But I don't think that same calculation is necessarily being made by the millions of people who are vaccinated. And again, that's not really a messaging that I feel like we're hearing. So I personally feel like I expect to see a lot of people get carried away in the exuberance of being vaccinated, and their behaviors start changing in ways that are not necessarily safe for them or for others at this point in time.
I also think there's at least in my own personal consideration, is the, just like that, our case counts are still relatively low right now. And the daily positivity rate remains like well under two. It's like, it's between 1% and 2%. And I mean, we'll see if that stays, but I think so long as it remains relatively low, I think I will at least personally feel a relative level of comfort. Just like, I mean, I did, when I woke up the day that I got the vaccine, I did not think that I was going to get the vaccine that day. But in the week prior to that, I had already sort of begun to I'm going to, okay, I can walk to the store and do errands in the store versus just not doing the errands at all, or piling it into basically an online order. And I don't know. I guess that's kind of my thought. I'm curious to see after I reach the fully vaccinated status. Like, I'm not going to do indoor dining anytime soon, because it's still like a giant unknown. Like, we're like kind of feeling great. And like, yes, I agree, I could also run through a wall, but also I'm like, wait, do I really want to do that? Might that, is it like, yeah. just hold your horses here.
I'm enjoying like the Kool-Aid man type. Oh yeah. got the vax.
So Friday of this past week, there was a release of a new video of an arrest made by LAPD officers of a black man in Hollywood whose name was Antoine Austin. This is a case that has, I've not really seen get a lot of attention. It has been covered by Jasmine Kanick, who is another independent journalist who is routinely covering issues, particularly as they affect Black Los Angeles and the it's not even just issues of policing. It is also issues of the predatory relationship between a lot of the city of Los Angeles and a lot of Black residents who live here. Exemplified perhaps by her coverage over the course of several years of Ed Buck, the Democratic donor who is alleged to have killed several Black men at his West Hollywood residence. In this case, Jasmine posted the video that was previously under seal on Twitter. This is a body cam footage of two cops in, as I said, in Hollywood, who are driving around responding to a report from a white woman that her significant other had been assaulting her. The police, as seen in this newly released video, are driving up and they see a black man, which is Mr. Austin, moving his recycling bins back to the back, or moving them towards his fence in this video, apparently moving them back to just where they're stored. They are heard saying, "Is that him?" The other cop says, "Probably," without any indication as to why they suspect that might be the case. They get out, ask him to turn around, and then begin to violently detain him, handcuff him. There's a great deal of shouting. I mean, this video is incredibly disturbing. I don't know. This is part of a civil lawsuit that's currently being filed against the LAPD for the violation of civil rights, both of Antoine Austin and of his girlfriend, who was also detained, who came outside in a bathrobe to try and stop her boyfriend from being arrested, and was like forcibly disrobed, basically, apparently unintentionally, but that was the effect by one of the police officers. What do you guys think watching that? This was a hard video to actually watch as it was posted on Twitter.
Lots of thoughts. I think the one is the extent to which white and light passing people truly do not comprehend that this is extremely routine for people who have dark skin and are black. And the video is not I don't know. I mean, there's that, right? That's just, it's like a lot of people don't even, like, they know because they saw something on the news about a video, as they'll see with this video, but it's like, huh, really, is it this bad? And it's like an experience that it's just not even going to happen for so many people. And that's, I don't know, one of the things I was thinking about. But also just the I guess, what I couldn't, like, and I guess I'm still processing, is the tone of one of the officers, the body cam, the one, his like like, Jesus Christ, why won't you just comply, was the tone. Like, he kept saying, and that's what I was, and that's what I'm still kind of chewing on, is I'm, like, trying to place that. Like, I have never been detained like that. And I'm trying to, like, place it in a, like, what is, what, like, how often does he do this? What is he expect, like, how often is this interaction repeated in, like, Los Angeles, which is lots. But, like, that specific, like, Jesus, like, I just remember Jesus Christ over and over again. Like, what is your problem, man? And I'm like,
yeah, what's wrong with you? What is wrong with you? I remember that.
Yeah.
What is your problem?
And, like, as a viewer, it's just like, I'm sorry. Like, when we have the factual situation, it's like, I'm like, what? Like, no, what's wrong with you, dude? Like, why are you? You're the one. And, like, I don't know. It's just, I think that's the guy. Like, it's like in, as much as departments, like, the department likes to focus on, like, the policy of the entire thing. It's like, oh, well, our policy is set up to prevent this entire situation from happening. And yet, like, it doesn't. Because here it is. Like, did you mix up the description of, like, it was a white man and this man had a white shirt? I have not read the court documents in this particular circumstance, but I'm just like, I don't know, isn't there supposed to be something? Or is there, you know, intentionally not? Or is this, like, I mean, that's a... I'll yield here, but, like, it's just...
Well, I mean, this is another case of police... The thing is, like, I feel like so much of the responses by city government, city officials, to not this specific incident, but to the entire conversation around the over-policing and the violent policing of Black and Brown Angelenos centers around our ability to train LAPD to de-escalate situations and from the perspective of numerous members of city council and the mayor, those efforts have been a success. The mayor has repeatedly said that the LAPD is nothing resembling the LAPD of the past. They are a gold standard for de-escalating conflicts, et cetera. And yet here we see, again, upon no provocation, we see them go in, hop out of a car, basically with the intention of escalating a situation, which is something we've seen many times. We've saw there was, of course, the video of police battering a man in Boyle Heights last year. There is seemingly endless evidence that the police view what everybody else would, I think, reasonably see as escalatory tactics as de-escalation and sort of like hopping out of your car, demanding somebody who's just minding their own business to allow themselves to be handcuffed and get on the ground and telling them, I don't know who I'm looking for, so I'm just going to detain you and we'll figure it out at the station is viewed as acceptable policing. And obviously, I think the city is defending these tactics right now in court and trying to say that somehow this is what this individual, this couple, deserved to happen to them in front of their residence, even as the woman who made the call to police is there being shoved away by the cops as she's saying, that's not him, I called, you know.
It reminded me a lot of which I think this also happened in Hollywood, right, during the protests in the summer, when there was a Black business owner had called the police to say that there were people threatening her with guns outside of her business, and the police roll up and they start to take them into custody instead of the people who are standing right there with guns threatening them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how policy changes this, really. I don't know. That would sort of imply that policy is the cause of the prejudicial treatment of Black people, which I know is a tempting and seductive line of reasoning for a lot of people who are not as affected by these issues here in Los Angeles. But I just don't see it.
I mean, it's the point to which institutional anti-Blackness, one, makes it worse for everybody, like in the sense of whether it's the woman who called the police because her husband was, if it was being abusive, that's okay. Well, she's not getting the service, or in the circumstance of the other store, being like, it's not, but also like you have to, that needs to be the starting point. There's no situation where hemming and hawing of political policy that like might include one line in the introduction that says policing disproportionately affects Black people, and then goes on to not discuss anything else other than that. But you have to, I don't know, like start with that situation, which is where you get to a discussion about abolition. I guess that's where the vernacular picks up. It's not like you're not talking about in like the American tradition of talking about anti-Blackness. I think that's where you have to look. And where we are increasingly looking at this particular point is that specific framework of, I guess, or that vocabulary of like how to talk about what to do.
Now, we also had big news at the LA Times, not good news, but Patricia Escarcega, the former co-food reviewer or co-food critic at the LA Times, along with Bill Addison, those two both hired to replace John Gold after his passing. Escarcega is leaving the paper. She announced on Twitter and also on her personal website with a very long and very big-hearted farewell and highlights from her 2 years at the paper. This followed a long battle, I think over a year at this point, where she was attempting to get the discrepancy in pay between herself and Addison addressed by management. Received a notice in November that would not be, the LA Times management basically said that they hired her as a junior critic while not telling her that, and while also billing the two of them repeatedly as co-critics. And now several months later, Patricia is out at the LA Times. Alyssa, what do you think about this one?
I mean, it is so, so sadly familiar. I have heard firsthand and also through various threads of the exact same thing happening. And we know about the institutional problems of the LA Times. I don't think any publication is immune to those same issues. Like, we're all facing some pretty troubling disparities, in particular with the way that, say, especially with critics, because this is a big conversation about critics too, among both in the architecture and design world where I kind of operate in a little bit, and in the food world too, is, you know, if we really want to give power and to people who are not white males, who have traditionally had all the power in these spaces, that means, you know, really changing the way that you are structuring your publication and what it covers, and giving people the space and the time to report the stories that are important to a non-white male gaze. An incredibly emotional thread. If you have time, please go read the entire thing. Read all of her stories. They are told with such care and such passion. Every single one. But how newsrooms are not going to learn this lesson. It doesn't seem like they're trying very hard to learn it, even though women in particular, and women of color in particular, keep raising the same issues over and over for why they are unable to operate within your confines.
It kind of points to like the thing that I have thought with this ongoing situation with her is the reluctance of news organizations in particular to embrace the concept of equal pay for equal work. And in fact, you actually get quite unequal pay for unequal work, where the younger, more female, more brown staffers work orders of magnitude harder than the tenured professionals sitting at the top with a significantly larger salary. And I don't know. I also think in this, like, I remember at a certain point, the Times made a point about, or maybe it wasn't the Times making a point. Maybe it was just like in the Reddit comments or something. Somebody was making the argument that, well, you have to consider, you know, the significant prestige held by this, by the awards and the, like, he won national awards and, like, this is, it's like that prestige has a value and, like, blah, 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 in that sort of vein. And it's like, I don't think it does. Like, that's my take. I don't think that winning a national magazine award for food writing or whatever, I don't think that should, like, I get that they're, like, in sort of American management culture, that is a sort of, you know, it's a value checkbox. It's a value add situation when the Times gets to say that we added this reporter who has these credentials. But I'm like, I don't know. I don't think, I think you're, it's pointing to it. We're at a moment where the old, in many respects, I guess, the old sort of, the old media norms of, like, credentialing, whether that's a piece of plastic that lets you get access to a crime scene or a, like, the credentials afforded with big fancy awards and basically just those things, I guess.
With steep admission, with steep fees, yeah, sometimes to enter those, or you have to be a staffer at the publication to be.
I mean, I think that you're right, Matt. I think that the LA Times did make the prestige argument in their response to Patricia in the fall, and I think it's an extremely wrong-headed argument. Right? It's like the awards are another frequent source of discussion in LA. We should know that better than anybody. Like, we talk about Oscars so white and the refusal of the Grammys to give Black artists album of the year and things like that. The award culture, it's like, if you are going to say, well, our hands are tied because, look, the white male co-critic has gotten all this prestige from these national awards institutions, then what you're actually doing is you're saying, until we solve the problem of the white patriarchal institutional racism within a variety of disaggregated awards ceremony, then there's nothing that we can do about pay equity in-house. It's a bizarre abdication of responsibility and also authority. You want to make positive changes, you can do this. And Bill Addison, for his part, I remember tweeted last year that he felt like they should be making the same amount of money, or had written a letter to that effect to LA Times management. So, like, this is, to me, this is a bizarre own goal by the LA Times to lose an incredible up and coming voice in LA food culture, to rob themselves of the ability to really to develop in-house talent, and also to speak to what is the experience of the majority of Angelenos who are brown, who are Black, who come from Hispanic backgrounds. Like, that, there's no excuse for this. They had actually even just settled a case saying that they were discriminating against, I mean, I should say the case alleged that they were discriminating against the brown and Black employees at the LA Times. They settled without acknowledging that they had done so. But for this to immediately follow that settlement indicates to me, at least, that not only are they refusing to admit that publicly, but they're not learning lessons from it internally either, which is, I don't know. It's deeply disappointing at a minimum. Before we get into our discussion with Jamie Loftus about Echo Park Lake, one more thing that we wanted to talk about. There is a Ralph's that is being closed in Crenshaw. Matt, what is happening here as you understand it, as far as the decision to close down this supermarket?
Not just this supermarket, but I think you guys have noted this before on the podcast, and it's been, the story's been out there for a couple of weeks now, that in response to the city of Los Angeles, the council and mayor signing off on, I think, a hero pay that grocery store workers should be given, I think it was a $5 bump in their pay for basically having to be in the grocery stores for the entirety of the pandemic. Kroger said, we're going to shut down 3 stores that were, I guess it seemed like they were planning to close them down at some point anyway, but like, well, with this new hero pay, we can't pencil it and we've got to shut it down. So there were 3 stores. There was the East Hollywood Food for Less at Sunset Western. There was a Ralph's at, I think it was like Pico, and it was somewhere by the West Side Pavilion or former of it. And then the other Ralph's where there was a protest this week at Crenshaw and Slauson. And the closing dates in the next couple weeks, and I think there's something in here. I can't speak for the one on the West Side, but for the other two, the Food for Less at Sunset and Western was going to be closed anyway, and this is across the street from the acclaimed Target, and that's gonna turn into a large mixed use residential development.
That's the new name for it, the acclaimed Target
at that site, and I think that is what will likely inevitably happen to the site at Crenshaw and Slauson, which is just the way that Los Angeles is rewriting its own land use is making the sort of big box store, the big box Food for Less, the big box Ralph's, like a less, I mean, even for the city, it's a less desirable option than a 6-story mixed use pavilion with a couple stories of parking and a Whole Foods on the ground floor or whatever. And at Crenshaw Slauson, when the Crenshaw line eventually opens, if it ever actually opens, there will be a metro stop right at that intersection. And so I don't know if you've gone down Crenshaw Boulevard lately, but there is a significant amount of new, very dense residential transit-oriented development, including immediately around that intersection. And so the height limit at that intersection on the Crenshaw-specific plan passed in, I believe it was 2017 or 2016, the documents were that I was looking at this morning. It's a 75-foot height limit right at that intersection. And basically, I mean, the particulars of that particular area are, it seems like it's kind of a complicated lot with multiple owners. So good luck to whatever commercial developer wants to actually build it there, but like, or build something there. But like, it is set up in a way that if somebody wants to build a 75-foot tall, like multi-story apartment complex with commercial development on the bottom, they can. So I would this is speaking beyond what I actually know, but like, I think you can make an educated guess that there is some attempt to consolidate property at that intersection and ready it for something further down the line, because the value of that land now exceeds what, it's driving a situation where that big box store in an area that has very, like, I remember blocking out a whole area looking for, like, okay, how many supermarkets are there between, like, King, down to Manchester, Figueroa to Crenshaw? That Ralph's is the only one in that. I need to fact check that. I should have done that before I came on the podcast, but I believe what I just said is accurate.
No, I'm pretty sure that is correct. And the situation in Crenshaw is such that what we are seeing here is a policy that was intended to help out the workers of the grocery workers at locations throughout the city that ended up, I think, actually being adopted by the county as well, being used in scapegoat fashion for a very large business, Kroger International Business, to be able to shut down a site in a food desert. Like, the thing is, it's impossible to get around that there are these stores throughout LA County, throughout Southern California, that are benefiting from the so-called hero pay policies, but places where employees are going to be earning the hazard pay that they should be. And in the middle of one of the very few remaining neighborhoods of Black Los Angeles, a ton of low-income workers are just losing their job. They're just going to be unemployed as a result of this, or move to other locations, possibly ones that they won't be able to easily get to you, you know, things like that. Dramatic changes to their quality of life. And like you said, Matt, seemingly in aid of an ongoing gentrification struggle, that was the reason for there being a protest there on Saturday. Like the group downtown Crenshaw, which Damian Goodman, also of the Crenshaw Subway Coalition, heads up, they protested the closure of the Ralphs, and I think are looking at a way in which either the store could be kept open or transferred to an ownership that would not result in a major gentrification pressure. I mean, it's like you're given two options, as we're about to talk about with Echo Park Lake. You're given two options, neither of which are what the community impacted really want to see happen. And you're told to choose between one of these two things. Either you have a food desert, or I don't know, you get a 75-foot building come in with apartments that people can't afford, and maybe stores that they can't afford to shop in. It shouldn't be that those are the only two choices. Also worth noting that Jasmine Kanick, who we talked about a few minutes ago, posted online that Naji Ali, who is a consultant for the LAPD, who is somebody who's frequently seen in the company of city council members, the mayor, et cetera, and held up inaccurately by major media outlets as being a voice representing the concerns of Black Los Angeles, apparently attacked at Damian Goodman at this rally, at this protest. That follows an event a couple months ago where he showed up at Goodman's house and was chased off the property by Goodman's neighbors following the call by Crenshaw activists to reject proposals to purchase the site of the Crenshaw Mall. So we'll be following that in more detail as it develops. Okay, so we have a long discussion with Jamie Loftus of Knock LA, and without further ado, we'll get into that now. All right, as promised, we have an excellent interview. Today, we are welcoming Jamie Loftus to the show. Jamie, for those unfamiliar, is somebody who is extremely talented in a variety of different areas. Writer, comedian, artist, podcaster, somebody whose voice is very important in local leftist politics. She writes and creates art about corporate appropriation of feminist themes and thought and misogyny in art and culture. You probably also have seen her, if you're listening to us, then you probably also have seen her videos that she's made about things like neighborhood council elections, how they work, and ADEMs, and the issues of policing that have been so central to the last year in Los Angeles. We're here having her in yet another of her many capacities, that of journalist. And she's been covering the life and the issues surrounding living unhoused in Los Angeles for Knock LA. Jamie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I was thinking, oh yeah, I didn't know how ADEMs worked until I had to make a cartoon about it. I was like, oh yeah, can someone write that down? I would love to know.
It's the best. I mean, so like it is boom times for civic education in Los Angeles. We have a lot of wonderful people doing work like that to learn about all these systems that are so opaque. But it's the best way to educate yourself, I feel like, is to actually dive in and be like, huh, I didn't know that we had to vote in an ADEM election or anything like that.
Right. And like, what does it stand for? What does it accomplish?
Why when I stand in line are people shouting at me to vote for their slate? Jamie, so as a journalist, I mean, it really seems like the situation in Los Angeles, the homelessness crisis that we cover and talk about a lot on LA Podcast, has morphed into kind of an all hands on deck situation for the media because it touches on so many different aspects of life here, mm-hmm. so many different failures of local government and society. I'm curious, how did you find your entry into covering the types of issues you write about for Knock?
Yeah, I started writing with Knock last year, kind of more just about like grassroots food efforts was kind of like where I started. But it just, I don't know, it quickly became all of these issues are so interconnected that through writing those stories, I met people who, you know, were like, oh, have you, you know, considered this angle? Have you considered this angle? And there, especially with Knock, there is just so much possibility of what you could write about and like the capacity for what they wanted to cover versus how many people were originally there. And as far as like coming up to like working on stories about Echo Park Lake, it kind of, it started about 6 months ago when I was just asked to write a story about Heidi Marston, which has like spiraled into so many different areas where that's like, that got me down the rabbit hole of the West LA VA and their like use of land and Veterans Row kind of on the west side of the city. And then also, you know, making connections at Lhasa and being in kind of continual contact with you know, Lhasa employees who are understandably really frustrated and confused about, you know, what's going on in their own workplace. So I think that, yeah, just even beginning to learn more about one person's career kind of spiraled out into like all these different areas.
Now, you mentioned Heidi Marston, the Wunderkind executive director of Lhasa, and I really want to return to the coverage you've done on her in just a minute and the effect that it had on your most recent work. But before we get to that, I think all four of us on this call have been present over the course of the past couple weeks at Echo Park Lake and talking to folks who formerly lived at the lake. Jamie, could you maybe talk to us a bit about what happened? We've of course covered it, but like what happened from your perspective at Echo Park Lake, and why did this particular sweep become national news?
Ooh, I guess, yeah, I was originally, I think like a lot of people covering the story thinking like, oh, I'm going to, you know, be here Wednesday morning and, you know, kind of do a write-up of the gathering that took place last Wednesday. And then, you know, kind of return the next day and go to the sleepover and do everything that was basically planned out. I think that the amount of press coverage on that morning was really interesting. And there was like, it felt like even just reflecting on how that day rolled out, that there was a lot of positive attention going on at the beginning of that day. And there were people that, you know, in my like timeline that aren't normally that civically engaged on a local level who knew about this and knew that this happened and were like, oh, wait, what is going on? And, you know, even if they don't live in the area, it just seemed like there was a heightened awareness. And so when the turn came, I feel like that kind of that energy of like, wait, this seemed like it was a really positive, good thing this morning. What is happening? It seems like that sort of carried through. And I mean, yeah, the escalation was so goddamn steep that, yeah, I mean, that was just my impression of it was there were just more eyes on it than I had ever seen, at least at one time.
It was to me like such an interesting, it's weird and cruel and unfortunate that this is happening as we seem as a region like really positioned to begin transitioning out of the pandemic, obviously still living with COVID, but there does seem to be more hope on the horizon for more people than there has been in a long time. It seems like a weird sort of bookend to what happened at the start of 2020 when we had a very similar set of sweeps targeting the residents at Echo Park Lake, who at that point had only been there for a couple months, and being beaten back by an outpouring of compassionate protesting. And then this time, of course, things went very differently. And I don't know. I mean, Matt, did you Did you have a perspective on why? It's like it all feels so meaningless that it seems hard to try and ascribe a rationality to it. But I did think it was very interesting that we had things like Ava DuVernay weighing in, Roxane Gay, all of these prominent LA voices who normally don't weigh in on local issues.
I would hesitate to say that Ava DuVernay and Roxane Gay don't weigh in on local issues, because I do think they do. The first thing that I thought just when you were sort of introducing the question was that as a bookend to the pandemic, kind of I think it happened now because the pandemic numbers are low, more or less. And as I've talked in other areas around the city at other parks where there are sort of the newly posted special enforcement and cleaning zones, I just remember a conversation I had a couple weeks ago at North Hollywood Park, which it's a much larger park than Echo Park Lake, but the sanitation and there was a care shower there. And I pointed out the enforcement cleaning signs and said, well, it says it's effective today, but when is the enforcement going to occur? And what they said was, well, we're not going to do anything until the pandemic is over, pointing to the whole CDC guidelines and everything. But I think now, kind of based off of like what you just said, is we're kind of reaching this point where it does seem like the pandemic locally is, you know, that excuse is going away, or the rationale for not doing enforced or enhanced cleaning. I mean, even though it has been going on in many different areas around the city, but at a wider scale, the mechanism has scaled back. But now that the pandemic numbers are low, it does seem like that was kind of the pretext for at least right now at Echo Park Lake. Like it does, I can't tell you exactly why it was that particular day, as opposed to a week or two or three into the future, because obviously the pandemic is not over. It is still very much here with us. But yeah, I mean, this is just me to echo your point about it is a bookend to the pandemic, and it is we're back here right now. That's kind of, or the pandemic has ended and now it's back to right where we were in February of 2020, which was when the last action was when.
Yeah. Right before everything shut down.
Yeah.
Jamie, you had a really excellent piece where you spoke with not only people who work within Lhasa, but also some of the former residents at the lake. Could you maybe tell us now, even with only a couple weeks on from these raids at Echo Park Lake, what is the situation for some of the folks who were formerly living encamped at the lake?
For the people I spoke to, it is very much in flux. It seems like kind of, you know, stories that we've heard about Project Roomkey in the past, but kind of turned up to an 11. The particularly with one source I spoke to, what I was unclear on was I knew that there had been a lot of pressure from not just Lhasa, but other service providers to leave the park for some time, but I wasn't sure what the timeline was and what the specificity of what was actually being promised. And so by speaking with people who had been living there, it seems like there was a really sudden escalation of all of a sudden service providers are at the park every single day, beginning around a week before the actual sweep took place. There's like a very heavy presence. They're making like literally doing laps around the park, saying like, "Have you thought about it? Have you thought about mm-hmm. it?" And that obviously, you know, by Thursday morning, when the entire park was fenced in, that was at an all time high. And the promise being made was, we have housing for you tonight. We can get you somewhere within Project Roomkey right now, essentially. And then the second that, you know, people would leave the park to say, okay, fine, you know, if that is the option, then I will accept that. It changes the second that they leave the park. The one person I spoke to in particular accepted the services, then was told, well, actually, you know, we don't have housing for you tonight, but we can get you somewhere in Culver City tomorrow. So she accepted housing, a hotel room overnight from Street Watch, which is the case for, I mean, Street Watch has been providing better and more effective and, you know, more dignified interim housing than any service provider. Then the next day, when she does go to the Project Room Key Hotel, like, you know, I think anecdotally, we've heard many times before, oh, actually, there isn't space here. You have to go somewhere else. She's then brought to Nest, which is, you know, a newer space that and is then told that not only do you not get your own, you know, unit like you would in Project Room Key, you're living with three strangers and you can only move freely from 12 to 4 p.m. every day. So it's, you know, essentially jail. And so then, you know, it takes four different tries for her to get any sort of meaningful housing. And even then, where Project Room Key, you know, you're supposed to get up to 90 days of a hotel room. And she said, she's told once she finally gets to her final destination, it's going to be maybe 2 weeks. And I spoke with her 2 days ago and she's already been moved to another place. It was only like 1 week before she was moved again. So it's just been for people who even received services, because there's other people who just fully did not receive services at all. But those who did accept and eventually receive services, it's just been complete chaos and being completely uprooted. And meanwhile, you know, it's like every number I've seen declared, like these like mission accomplished style numbers of people being rehoused are all so wildly different. And completely, like, I have not gotten anyone to answer for like, what do you mean by this number? Could you, you know, it's just right. The mission accomplished number.
I mean, to that point, you included in your article some comments questioning. I mean, what I observed was the numbers that were provided directly from Mitch O'Farrell's office ramped up really, like they just kept changing throughout the course of a couple day period.
Yeah.
One might expect that, okay, maybe more people are moving into these types of temporary shelters. But they seem to kind of grow out of proportion, basically to the point where he was saying, we got 100% or possibly even more than that of all the people who were staying at Echo Park Lake into temporary shelters, whereas that the numbers that his office gave were much higher than what was what you were able to find elsewhere. What were the where were the disparities coming into play between what Mitch O'Farrell's office was saying and what other sources were saying?
Mitch O'Farrell's number, I honestly still cannot make heads or tails up. He gave the number 209, which is very high and very specific. And but there's no like indication in that number, like starting when and where and how and for how long, you know, just all of these questions that if you know about these services that are like really obvious questions. But if you're just living in District 13 and wanting to believe that this, you know, quote unquote problem has been resolved, you're like, oh, 209. Great. Cool. But internally, I mean, it's just the difference between what organizers at Echo Park Lake and what Mitch O'Farrell were saying in terms of numbers is like Mitch O'Farrell is estimating that 3.5 times the amount of people who organizers at the park are saying were put into temporary housing were. And then Lhasa kind of is falling somewhere in the middle at around 100. And they did in some internal emails say that, you know, in the week between like the Friday and the Thursday that the sweep is taking place, that they were able to put 102 people in to transitional housing, and also numbers that they would not substantiate to me in any way. So
I kind of want to just talk about Project Room Key in general. I mean, I know that it's very difficult to parse from the outside what this program looks like. I feel like there's been sort of a rapid reassessment among leftist activists, partially just like in response to the heavy-handed approach at Echo Park Lake of what exactly the benefits and costs of this program are for unhoused folks. I know that NOC has published journalism. I think Sam Lutzker had a piece about the treatment of people who accepted services through Project Roomkey. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, up until really like early March, there was a concerted line of attack against the city by activists who are saying, we have so much underutilized capacity in hotels, seize the hotels. We have the ability to get FEMA reimbursement. Do any of you feel like there is like a terrible food in such small portions thing going on? I mean, I think that there are very real issues with Project Roomkey, and the opacity of the program is the lack of transparency is a foremost, in my mind, issue among them. But I'm curious, where does Project Roomkey fall in each of your assessment in terms of its ability and current uses for helping unhoused people currently?
I want Matt to answer this because I feel like his reporting on Bridge Home is so relevant to the options.
Yeah, I think just I guess a little bit of extra context on Project Roomkey and its genesis is that if you go back to March of 2020, early April of 2020, there was a very explicit fear on the part of our local government and the state government in particular that was the coronavirus was going to rip through the unsheltered population. This was a conscious, explicit, publicly reported on thing on the part of specifically the Newsom administration that they were worried that so many unsheltered people were going to basically get sick, that alone would overwhelm the hospital system so that, well, maybe if you got sick and needed an ICU bed, oh no, too bad, the hospitals are already full. And it was that was the fear that led to the CARES Act including a line item that said we can reimburse for non-congruent shelter to do what eventually became PRK. It wasn't out of like the goodness of the public authorities' hearts that we're going to, oh, there's this awful pandemic, well, we should really try and find shelter. It was an explicit worry that the medical system would be overwhelmed by the health needs of a medically vulnerable population that, well, maybe your 77-year-old housed mother from Marin County might also not have a hospital bed. I think that's really, really indicative when it comes to like seeing how the program has played out. It was never born to like cater to the needs of the people who it was going to ostensibly be serving. Because again, it wasn't serving the people who are being moved into the rooms. It was serving, in theory, or at least at its genesis, everybody else in an attempt to try and mitigate the potential effects of a fear of like a hospital system not working. And I think because that the end user from our perspective, from the unhoused person's perspective, from the perspective of somebody at Echo Park Lake being said, hey, we have a room for you, their needs were not and continue to not be prioritized in the sort of engineering and just the whole rollout of the program, right? So that's why you have sites that are relatively punitive. My understanding of PRK is I've talked to some people who are fine with it. It seems like some sites are operated in a much less tyrannical, tyrannical manner than other sites. But by now, I can't necessarily speak. This was like in October of last year that I got reviews from there. But it changes. And the whole point about the end user not being considered, that's, I guess, my whole thing. And I think that's a really, really important point in like viewing how it works out. Because there are a lot of people who like will accept a 7 p.m. curfew. But also, if you don't have control over the act, ironically, you don't have a room key to lock your door on your Project Roomkey room, and somebody comes in there at night and makes you do like a strip search, basically looking for whatever paraphernalia you may or may not have. I don't know. Like that's it. It there was the standards were not like set until much later after the program was actually going on, and basically by the time you were actually shutting it down, which is still where we are. So you have a lot of different variants from site to site, and there's no consistent user experience. And that's why I guess it's a mixed bag. There are a lot of people who are very happy with their indoor plumbing and will accept a 7 p.m. curfew because that's just where they are in their life. at the same time, there are a lot of people who are, and like rightfully so, because the sites themselves have such a variance that like some sites are run in a much more dictatorial manner and the people cannot exit their room ever. And that's not a good situation.
Right. Like Jamie said, that's a jail.
Yeah, right? Basically that is the number one complaint is that I have no agency and I'm made to stay in my room. And then people come into my room and accost me in my room, which is not what we should be going for and not gonna do anybody any good in the long run.
I have so many thoughts about Project Room Key and the way that it's been used, but I also just, I every time I think about it or have a discussion with people like you all about it, it's like there are just so many gaps in, I feel like, what is even publicly known about this. But what has been really, what I personally think has led to so much consternation over the course of the past couple of weeks among people who are activists on behalf of the unhoused, but are not actually unhoused themselves, is that from our perspective, what we're seeing is politicians use Project Room Key as effectively as a cudgel, like to say like, okay, we have offered you service, just like a generic paint can with the label service on it. We've offered you a bucket of service. And if you say no to this, then we can do whatever the hell we want to you. They have very effectively, Mayor Garcetti has for a long time now been pushing what in my mind is a very noxious line about service resistance, basically saying that there is a large rump population within the unhoused cohort who, no matter what we do, no matter how hard we try, no matter how bright our Care Bear hearts get, they will not accept help from us. And that is frankly not true. Like you said, Matt, it requires that you leave out the fact that the end users of the services are not really being considered as services are provided or offered. But at Echo Park, we see, I think, really the full flowering of that line of attack, because it allowed and facilitated the conversion of an entire neighborhood into a police state on the basis of, we offered you Project Room Key with an arbitrary termination date. You have until this day to comply. And if you don't do that, you either go to the street or you go to jail. And whatever happens next is entirely on your head. Is Project Room Key salvageable if it is part of that type of enforcement? I don't expect anyone to necessarily be able to answer that, but I'm curious what you all think.
I was thinking too about the difference between bridge home shelters, which we don't hear as much about. I don't know the numbers of like how many people are in the bridge home, and we still have emergency shelters and we still have winter shelters. So we still have, even though most of the emergency shelter, the COVID emergency shelters have been closed. I would, because of course, like as Matt and others have reported, like the biggest problem with bridge home system is that there's nothing on the other side of the bridge. And once you time out there or you reach the end of your stay, there's nowhere for you to go. So I would just be, now the city is introducing these new solutions, like the tiny home village. Like, what are the parameters there? There's going to be another one. There's being another one being built right by Echo Park Lake. Again, with the timing, I question that in my story. Why not at least wait till you could have put everybody there who wanted to go in an interim situation where they'd at least be in the same neighborhood? Like, there's so much confusion about what the options are. And at the same time, the city bought these properties, like that Nest property. It was purchased, a brand new apartment building was purchased by the city in December, I think, along with like 10 or 12 other properties. Some were hotels and some were brand new apartment buildings. Doesn't that seem like the best way forward is to actually be purchasing brand new empty apartment buildings as a solution where you could give people keys to their room and not force them necessarily under certain circumstances? So it seems like there are many more paths forward is what I was trying to say, like, and there are many more options than there were on the table just a few months ago. But if you're still forcing people into shelter situations with rules and nowhere to go when they get out of there, it doesn't seem like we've made any kind of progress at all. It seems like we're just going to be moving people around from place to place, which is like the greatest fear, right? You're just uprooting people from communities over and over.
I agree. I mean, I think that in terms of Project Room Key, it is, I totally agree with Matt. The experience is so person to person and site to site, where, you know, that there are people I've spoken to that, you know, get along really well with people who work at their specific site and are able to have a little more freedom because they get along. And then, you know, other situations where it couldn't be more different. What kind of worries me about these new sites that are coming up, because I'm just, in the process of trying to learn more about sites like Nest that look so promising, and then you find out this is like the most restrictive site I've ever heard of.
Right. Yes, of right. course. Yeah. I guess I'm thinking more like the form of the building itself as like a place you could actually live. Right. But you're right. Yeah. There's different rules imposed for each one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just the level of disorientation for someone who is being shuffled from place to place and having to, you know, adapt to a completely new set of rules, a completely new, you know, living layout. And like all of your reporting indicates, Matt, like nothing on the other side of it. It's just a new set of punitive rules from site to site.
And I think also practically important with, I guess, homeless services generally and how the system works, whether you're placing somebody in a bridge housing location or a PRK room or even like a subsidized apartment through like Housing for Health or like the Flex Housing Subsidy Fund, like all of these sort of rental subsidy sort of programs that like are good models, but then you just place somebody in a neighborhood where they've never been. And so distinct what you just said, you also, like, I wish, like, for people who haven't experienced it, you have to realize that when you're placing somebody into a neighborhood that they do not know, for the most part, people don't have transportation. So it's like your concern becomes, okay, well, where do I get my groceries? And that will occupy a significant amount of time. You have to figure out where the bus goes. How far away is your local grocery store? Do they accept the CalFresh? Do I even have my CalFresh address is like at a different spot across town? How do I get that? And it's like these very tangible, practical realities that for the most part, these are user needs that like are not being accounted for. And like in the day-to-day living experience of the people we're attempting to serve, like occupy a significant portion of the time. So it's like somebody can't spend their time looking for an apartment because they're trying to figure out, well, I have to get to my Medi-Cal appointment, but it's now across town and the bus service is once every hour. Like here I am placed in a hotel in the Northeast San Fernando Valley, but my care clinic is downtown. Mm-hmm. And like I have two buses and a rail transfer to do. And that's like a whole like you need to start from like that position when trying to figure out how to meet people's needs and realizing that those are the needs that are there. Then just saying, hey, we got a room for you in Culver City tonight, but then tomorrow night you're going to be over in Westlake, and then maybe we'll move you out to the Valley some point else. Because like even in the best circumstance, then you're paying a services caseworker to basically just drive that person around Southern California, which happens. That is a huge, like in terms of like our like homeless service worker, like we're paying MSWs to basically drive people around Los Angeles because our public transit system is too inadequate to actually get people to where they need. Like that's a whole other conversation in terms of the services system. But like, I think is a very indicative example of like how it doesn't work in very practical ways, because again, it's not about that person's need. It's just saying, well, we gave you a room. Even though it was in Culver City, it was still a room and it like it had a bathroom. And like, well, if you didn't want to accept that, that's fine. But we did our part. We we did our part to fulfill the like that we checked off the box to say we offered services before threatening criminal enforcement.
And it's and that's what's really so important, I think, to from the city government perspective here in Los Angeles, you know, a city where there are 14 Democrats and one notional independent on the city council, being able to say we're not cold hearted, we're offering services is crucial to supporting the narrative that council members like Mitch O'Farrell are trying to put forward, that they are one of the good guys, one of the good people doing the right thing. I want to say, like, since I started this by suggesting that there was some hypocrisy in wanting to expand Project Room Key but also not liking it, I would like to say I personally don't see that as being the case. I think that is now something that we are seeing more effectively spread in the media by council members who are perhaps not acting in the best faith, by the mayor himself, who said that homeless activists and unhoused people did not understand the issues that they were talking about following Echo Park. I personally, the way that I see it, if we were to take something that has been said, seize the hotels at face value, like you were saying a minute ago, Matt, that is very different from what has actually been done. In effect, what we have created is with Project Room Key is a program where the needs of, and the really, frankly, the desires of hotel owners have been put far, far above the homeless individuals who are the city is seeking to house. You mentioned the framing, thinking about this from the framing of trying to prevent the hospital system from being overwhelmed. In the case where that's not happening, or maybe it is happening, but it's not being driven by the wildfire spread of COVID through unhoused populations, the city almost philosophically feels very little pressure to expand this program. We have seen continual deferrals of attempts to expand Project Room Key to be able to house more people. And because the seizure of the hotels, which is something that the city has the authority to do, the mayor has the authority to do as long as they pay them, they could actually set the terms however they want, basically. But they have allowed Project Room Key to be set up in such a way that they're begging on their hands and knees for hotels to allow people to stay there. And they're making lots of concessions about the terms so that it becomes a much more punitive environment. And the personal liberties of unhoused individuals just not really considered at all. And I think that any time that they wanted to, city council, which clearly exerts an enormous influence, as Jamie wrote about, over loss, could make those kind of changes to the policies of the program. We could expand this and have it be a more beneficial program for unhoused people. Even then, it wouldn't be, you know, one size fits all for everybody, but it could be a better program and a larger program. That's well within our power. But as you mentioned, we have Lhasa, we have Lhasa driving folks around. We have an agency that should know and be more in touch with the needs of unhoused folks. Jamie, you spoke with some of them. What is your read on how Lhasa is reacting to this latest change in the city's approach to handling homelessness with respect to what was just seen at Echo Park Lake? Do they feel like they are being put over a barrel to do all of these things, or what is their read on the situation?
I spoke with two people at kind of different levels of power within Lhasa about this, of just to get an idea of, you know, internally, how much was known to the lead up of this. Was there any knowledge that there would be some sort of violent escalation? What were they prepared for? And what I know that seems to have been like very common knowledge at LASA, kind of at every level, was that the switch for targeting Project Room Key services was changing from the original kind of first priority, which is, you know, people over 65 and people with pre-existing conditions, and shifting that to geographical targeting of specific encampments. So, and the ones I heard cited kind of over and over were Echo Park Lake, and where else? There was an encampment in Eagle Rock that was brought up, and Skid Row. So, the frustration that I was hearing, and something that seems to have been an existing frustration internally for some time, is the fact that the original stated system was being undermined. There are still people who are over 65 or have pre-existing conditions waiting for Project Room Key services, who have been waiting for nearly a year at this point, and now all of a sudden they are being pushed question mark spots down the line again, depending on whose numbers you're taking at face value. And, you know, one person I spoke to said, you know, at this point, because of when Project Room Key is slated to end, there could be someone who, you know, never receives the services, who's been on the waiting list for well over a year by September. And what LASA employees I spoke to didn't seem to really be prepared for was the escalation. It doesn't seem to be spoken about very much even in meetings in the following days. It was just kind of radio silence in terms of, you know, what was the managerial reaction. I thought it was interesting that Heidi Marston kind of came out against the police escalation. I honestly wasn't expecting that. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see her, you know, openly say, you know, I don't think that this is actually going to help people get housed. I don't think this is going to be helpful. But then internally, you see kind of a similar declaration of victory of, you know, well, we have put this many people into temporary housing. So all things considered, we did something good here. And so, I mean, I've never spoken to a LASA employee who wasn't, you know, frustrated about something in that chain of command. And it seems like, especially with so many people working remotely, that problem has been compounded in the past year, and it's become all the more easy to not receive key communications. And yeah, so I mean, the fact that the goals of Project Room Key had kind of shifted from prioritizing the most vulnerable people to geographical targeting was known, but the escalation and the fallout was very much as much a surprise to the people I talked to as it was to us.
And I know you just like have to wonder, for people who work at LASA, when this is the same council member. We're talking about CD13 council member Mitch O'Farrell, who targeted a LASA employee for termination successfully over that employee's advocacy at Echo Park, successfully fighting against the clearance of the lake encampment last year. You kind of just have to feel like, how safe do any people, like when you mentioned Jamie not having follow-up or conversations internally about the brutality of these tactics in the following days, it's like, would you even feel comfortable having that conversation? We know that so many people in the department have been intimidated, subject to intimidation based on their views, more or less. I do want to mention, so at the end of your piece, you had a very interesting, I thought, unusual editorial note about LASA's refusal to comment based on previous reporting that you and Nock had done about Heidi Marston. What happened there? Like, what was that conversation like?
Yeah, that was... I'd never had a conversation quite like it. There had been previous reporting on much of it by me about Heidi Marston, both at, not just at Lhasa, but also her time at the VA a couple of years ago. And I had reached out to comment from Heidi Marston at that time, which was, I think this was back in November, December. Didn't receive anything, and then later received a 2,000 word list of corrections. And it was a 14 or 15 item list of things. And we reviewed everything. We made, two small changes based on what was submitted, and then kind of considered it done, because we mm-hmm. reviewed the other 13 items and 2,000 words and said, okay, these are the changes that actually, we will, concede that makes sense. Then kind of considered it done. So when I was working on this piece, I had 5 or 6 questions that I sent to her, I don't know if I'm using the correct term here, but her, the PR representative with her office and Heidi Marston as well, expecting to, maybe not hear back at all. But what I ended up hearing was, and I want to make sure I'm characterizing this correctly, but we ended up getting a message back that basically said, we would be delighted to answer these questions, but we first need these corrections, these other 13 corrections that we noted for your last piece to be addressed. So basically they were like, we're withholding comment until you retract, previous reporting,
mm-hmm.
Which I was like, that's a, that's a bold ask. And so, it essentially amounted to like, they never sent comment because we, got editors involved and they explained, we made, here are the 2 changes we made that made sense. Mm-hmm. We consider the matter closed. And they said, okay, best of luck. So it seems like, for me specifically, I hope not for all of NAC, but that door has been closed. There, we're not going to get any comment from Lhasa about anything, So it's just, a weird withholding comment blackmail situation. I don't know. It was strange.
In a way, it kind of mirrors what I feel like has become a larger trend of the two-tiered treatment of the media by government agencies. We had, while the Echo Park raids were going on, we had LA Times journalists Ben Oreskes and Emily Alpert Reyes being allowed into the open-air jail that had been constructed around the lake. Nobody else was permitted entry, including Alyssa was denied entry. And then, of course, the very disparate treatment by the police the night of actually Wednesday and Thursday nights of that week, when several members of the independent press were detained and arrested, held in custody for much longer. Very, very awful. But we are glad at least to have you on this beat and covering these stories. Do you have anything that you could tip for our listeners about what they could maybe expect from you next? What other work you're looking at in the near future?
I'm currently kind of continuing on the West LA VA beat. At the moment, there's so many different points of entry there, but that's probably where I'm going to be sticking for the next stretch.
And for people who don't know, I think you both have reported on this. Like, that is kind of like an urban camping site that we have for people. There's a safe parking lot. There's a place where you can put up a tent. It almost is like a really good model that Echo Park could have been or could have informed, or it just seems like. And I'm glad you're keeping on that story, because it is somewhat of a success, and there are some good things to be learned from there too. So it's a great pivot to look at what hopefully won't get uprooted as another community that's actually maybe working for some people.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jamie, where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Jamie Loftus Help. And then I'll be on Knock LA for the foreseeable future.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. And everybody who is listening, thank you for listening. Brian Holmes, thank you for producing this episode. And we will be back next week with a new episode.